Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Network. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for joining us. And on Federal News Network, we've done a good amount of reporting about the serious deficiencies federal employees and military members are seeing when it comes to getting access to health care in Japan. On this edition of the show, we're going to talk about that, but not just about that. We're also going to talk about military spouse unemployment. In the case of Japan and Okinawa specifically, the two things are very related. A new report by a volunteer group of experts called Hire Oki Spouses found there are actually plenty of spouses in Okinawa with healthcare expertise who could be working as nurses, for example, to solve the provider shortage there. They're just not being hired. On the show this time, we're joined by two of the co-authors of the report, who've both lived in Okinawa recently and seen a lot of these issues firsthand. Kelly Pretorius is a PhD healthcare researcher and licensed nurse practitioner, and Elaine Sejung is an Air Force spouse, public health researcher, and another co-author of the report. Thank you both for joining us, and I think as we get into the conversation, we're going to talk about how a lot of these issues that you uncovered and recommendations you made are broadly applicable in some ways beyond healthcare and beyond Japan. But I want to start in Japan, and I want to start on healthcare. Talk to us about how this group came together to put together this research paper that you came away with. What was what were the circumstances and the need that prompted all this? How did this group get organized in the first place? Elaine, you want to start us?
Sure. So, you know, it's kind of hard to summarize 3 years, which is the time that I spent out there from 2020 to 2023, but it was during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so there was a lot of focus on healthcare and healthcare response and limited resources during that time. So I worked for Marine Corps Air Station Futenma as an emergency manager, and I was involved in some of the COVID response that was being held jointly on island. And along with that, I kind of had my hands and just knew a lot of different people. I was able to see both the DOD response and some of the spouses and what they needed, which I think is interesting when you're looking at a federal installation that is overseas. Typically, when you're dealing with a public health emergency, you have a lot of involvement from the local and the state level. But when you're overseas, it is purely the federal government, and you're missing those connection pieces for civilians, the civilian population. So again, I was able to talk to a lot of the spouses and hear their stories, many of which were healthcare providers who came to Okinawa during a pandemic and thought for sure they wouldn't have a hard time getting employed. But that actually wasn't the case. And I think, I'll say with Kelly and I actually met each other, I think it was 2023 during the beneficiary town hall, when the civilian advocacy group had kind of collected their individuals to advocate for access to healthcare. And the spouses who had been advocating for access to healthcare for, 18 months or so were also there present. And Kelly and I were kind of sitting side by side and talking about some of the challenges together. And that's how we met.
We sat next to each other, and then we were the first speakers to speak.
Yeah. And she had brought up, you know, the access to healthcare challenges. And I brought up, you know, what about the military spouses who are here, who are healthcare workers? How are we working to engage them and help with this issue? And then the issue with the Kadena pregnancy divert back to the U.S. That happened in June of 2023. I had just left the island, and I have to say that I received several Facebook messages overnight, and I woke up to just a barrage of individuals saying, hey, did you see this? And I felt like I had left a void that I didn't want to leave, knowing that I had spent years there helping these spouses, you know, advocate for healthcare resources and advocate for employment. So I kind of took that to professionals that we knew who were subject matter experts, Kelly being one of them, but many others. There's someone from our team who started Nurses of Okinawa Facebook page, which is essentially one of the largest resources for nurses on Okinawa to figure out how to get employed or how to maintain their credentials. I reached out to her. I reached out to some active duty service members and said, hey, how can we better engage these healthcare workers who are on island? If we're saying that there's a healthcare worker shortage, if that's truly the problem, then how do we make sure that we're utilizing the very limited resources that exist worldwide? And that's how the project came to be. I will say, and I was mentioning to Kelly, this is something I want to point out, it is a project. We don't intend for these individuals to do this long term. We don't intend for more unpaid volunteer work to happen out of this. What we wanted to do was kind of fill the space with information and data from people who were experts in healthcare and experts in Okinawa.
Elaine brought up the Kadena Divert situation, and I'd like to, for folks who weren't tracking what was going on about that, Kelly, can you just describe what happened with that? There are more issues with healthcare in Japan than we have time to get into in this interview, but sure. I think that one is kind of emblematic to give folks a sense of how dire things have been.
Sure, I'll do it succinctly. And so I think that DOD civilians that were not active duty had been facing some pretty severe access to healthcare obstacles. The active duty population was as well, but not to the extent that we're talking about that occurred in Kadena. So what happened is the Kadena Medical Group made the decision to send all of their pregnant, I guess it was active duty or spouse as of active duty, were basically told on very short notice, you will not be able to deliver at Naval Hospital Okinawa. You will be either delivering in the local economy, which basically means at a Japanese hospital, if you're able to find a Japanese hospital that could take you, or you were going to be diverted to Hawaii. And at that time, actually, Hawaii or Tripler, which is the medical treatment facility that some of the high-risk OBs or pregnancies go to anyway, was actually at that time not even able to absorb that population either. So people were kind of scrambling to then find another place to go. So at that point, I had also just left Japan. My name was also kind of well known in the community. So I also woke up to like 30, I can't even tell you how many messages from people. I then connected a lot of women that had reached out to me with some reporters. We got a story published and then the policy was reversed the next day. What happened though is they ended up hiring a bunch of contractors to fill the supply of the shortage of labor and delivery nurses at that time. And that's where the big struggle was. But I should say, I also was contacted by like NICU nurses at Naval Hospital Okinawa that were saying, well, this is great for L&D, but we also are really short-staffed in the NICU. Anyway, so then basically pregnant women that were affiliated with Kadena were then able to stay on island and to deliver their babies there because they then hired a bunch of contracting nurses. I don't know if that is a succinct. I'm trying to keep it short.
No, it's a good summary. And I know there's a lot more to say, but that I think that gives folks sort of a flavor for how serious things are out there. And so when you put everything that we've heard together, basically the situation that you have is there is a dire healthcare provider shortage in the military health system in Japan and a surplus of unemployed healthcare workers who are military spouses. The number that you estimated, I think, was a 49% unemployment rate among healthcare workers who are military spouses out there. Let's talk about some of the reasons that you found for that. How can this mismatch possibly exist? Talk us through the most important factors that you came away with.
Yeah, so I'll touch a little bit on that. It's really complicated because we didn't find one key factor that we could point to. And I think this is for people who are listening, who are familiar with, you know, military spouses and quality of life. Corey Weathers just wrote a book on the military culture shift. And she had talked about wicked problems within the Department of Defense and the wicked problems being so complex, it's really hard to tackle. And I really see military spouse unemployment, especially healthcare worker unemployment overseas, one of those wicked problems. But that doesn't mean that we just throw in the towel and say, we're not going to, you know, deal with this issue. I think we have to get into the trenches and look at all of the problems. And so one of those, to answer your question, is that we have a lot of spouses who are younger. So the younger spouse population on Okinawa frequently does not necessarily meet the 2-year experience requirement. And so the challenge with that, when you're looking at a military family, is the younger spouses actually potentially need the income more than the older spouses who have, you know, who are married to someone who has a higher rank. You know, these individuals are potentially coming in with student loans, don't have a lot of experience, already have debt, and they're hoping that they can get employment in a field that they've been told is, you know, relatively easy to get into. And then they find out that they're actually unemployed for, you know, however long that they're going to be there because they don't have the core experience needed to get employed by the military treatment facility. The other issue is the obvious.
Elaine,
Sure.
Really quick, because I think it's, I just want to point out, as somebody, just before you expand on that, I'm not military, right? So my husband works for the DoD, but as someone that was not familiar with the military lifestyle, I think it is important that your average person understand that the recent survey that was done, that one in four families is food insecure, right, within our military. And a lot of people are on WIC. And so I think a lot of us assume, oh, well, you're in the military, you're paid a decent wage, you're able to survive. And that's actually not necessarily the case. And so you do have a very large younger population. And so that barrier to having a certain number of years experience before you can take the job is pretty significant. I just want to add the context to that, because that was something that I didn't really understand until I dug in a little bit more, that a lot of these families are really limited in their resources. And then you're also geographically isolated. You don't have your family support. You don't have parents that can help provide childcare. So you have to pay for childcare. It's hard to establish childcare. There's a wait list for certain places, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of additional challenges that come with living overseas, especially amongst the military family population. Okay, sorry, Elaine.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that you added that, because that's absolutely true. One of the other issues with hiring healthcare workers, or just quickly hiring people in general, is the federal government processes, right? The hiring processes take a very long time. And so when you're talking about spouses who go to a 2 to 3 year overseas assignment, by the time you get overseas and you qualify for military spouse preference and you apply to the position, you're looking at 6 to 12 months, and then you're leaving in another 12 months, 12 to 24. And so just the time it takes for onboarding is a challenge, and that's part of the barrier. Now, the other flip side of that is, not only are we talking about the MTF hiring, but if you're looking at stateside, those spouses could go get employed in an off-base military or an off-base hospital. That's not the case in Japan. These spouses can't just go and apply to the local Japanese hospital because they don't speak the language, they don't understand the cultural requirements or the requirements of the hospital. So that in and of itself is a barrier for off-base hiring.
Kelly, yeah, we're actually not allowed to be hired off base, because I was actually, when I was looking for a job, I found like a school nurse position at a Japanese school, even though it was international, but I'm not licensed in Japan, and I wouldn't even be eligible to sit for that licensure. And so the principal was like, oh, shoot, you can't work for us. So it's not even a possibility. We have to be employed by an institution that's an American institution.
You perfectly anticipated my next question. You talked about the licensure issue with respect to working in the Japanese economy, but what about on base? Are there licensure barriers to working within an MTF if you have, you know,
no.
If you're okay.
Not typically, but again, when I was living in Okinawa, and I lived in Okinawa from 2019, and then we left in 2023, at that time, there were no openings. I'm a nurse practitioner, and there were no openings for nurse practitioners. And so that's when I had to volunteer instead at the hospital to maintain my licensure. And so different types of medical professionals will have different requirements that they have to maintain. And so for me to maintain my license, I had to then volunteer and pay for childcare so that someone could watch my son while I worked for free so that I could maintain my licensure.
That is Kelly Pretorius, also talking with Elaine Sejung. They are both volunteer researchers with the group Hire Oki Spouses and co-authors of the report we've been talking about. Many more details still to come as we jump back in after a short break. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Servale. Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Talking with Kelly Pretorius and Elaine Sejung. They are volunteer researchers with the group Hire Oki Spouses, as we continue to talk about military spouse unemployment, how it relates to healthcare in Okinawa and around the world. And getting back to some of the federal hiring process issues that you brought up, Elaine, it's a notoriously slow process. But at the same time, there are authorities that the government can use to hire military spouses, to give them preference to directly hire them, take them out of that very long 100-day pipeline. What do we know about the extent to which that's been used for healthcare in Japan or anywhere else?
Yeah, so I can say when we started this project, and something that we haven't mentioned is the project started as two workshops that we held with the community to say, what are the barriers that you're facing as far as employment? And we included DoD spouses, we included military spouses, but we also included HR and individuals from the MTFs to provide their feedback. And what we found is there was a very broad awareness of the direct hiring authorities, but it wasn't necessarily being utilized to the extent that the individuals in the workshop felt like it could be. And so one of the recommendations, one of the key recommendations that came out of the workshop was to max communicate to the community, to hiring managers, to HR about these direct hiring authorities and how to use them, because there's multiple types and multiple avenues that they could go with. But it doesn't seem like there is quite the connection between the hiring manager and HR on how to put that in place. It does seem like since we've had the workshops, though, that more direct hire authority positions have come out. So I will say that I have seen an improvement is what it looks like.
I would say that I feel that there was a shift when the Kadena incident happened, where the women were being sent either when that whole incident happened, that there was quite a shift. I would say that before that happened, it appeared, and I should say that the DHA was cutting their medical billets, and they were really functioning at a very, very limited capacity. And so again, I haven't seen like official reports, but we had a lot of whistleblowers that had contacted and kind of shared some information with me and via some other channels. So I think that the big issue too is that there weren't really job openings in the first place. There weren't billets for us to even apply for the most part. And I think that that's referenced in the number of hires in Japan from that document. So a whole nother step to all of this is actually having the Defense Health Agency create the billets so that they can even be filled in the first place. And you can't even fill a position if there isn't a position to be filled in the first place. And we have a lot of contract positions, but I don't know what the plan is and the longevity for that specific position, if that makes sense. And I should also add that a lot of the contract positions are actually filled by DOD like employees who themselves cannot receive healthcare at the institution in which they're providing healthcare. So then the sustainability is also questionable, because I think once people realize the situation that they're in, we've had some people go, oh, and then they're trying to then leave. And so it's kind of a whole nother step in, hey, we need these positions to be there in the first place.
It's such an important point, and it gets back to, I think, your personal experience there, right? Because the fact that there were no jobs for you to be hired into was not a function of the fact that there was no demand for services. It's just that there were no job openings.
Exactly.
In the listening that you all have done so far, and in whatever discussions that you've had with folks out in Japan, do you have any good sense for why those positions either decreased or did not increase to respond to that demand?
I do not know.
And it's okay if the answer is no.
I don't know. I just know that there's a significant level of desperation from both our, I think I started advocating for DOD civilians without realizing what was occurring to our active duty population. And I would say now it's shifted to where our active duty population deserves better and needs more access to healthcare. And it does seem, I think Elaine's point is really beautiful, that well, you have this whole community here of very qualified people that could very easily fill that void. So how do we facilitate that? I do think that one of the key points is involving the DHA to create those billets, as well as all of these other recommendations that our report outlines.
Yeah. So going back to the report, one of those sort of eye-popping details in there is via the Freedom of Information Act, you got data from OPM, who was supposed to be tracking all of these military spouse direct hire actions. And they knew of, I think it was 9 instances in which that authority had been used over the course of about 4 years. I think nobody really thinks that's the right number, but either the number's extremely low or it's not being tracked adequately, which, Elaine, I think gets us into some of the recommendations that you had on the government's ability to track all of this, track the need for spousal employment, track the availability for these jobs. Where were some of the biggest areas where you saw these data gaps?
Yeah, so I would say the biggest area, honestly, is we're not diving deeply enough into the local data. So a lot of the military spouse unemployment data is under a broad umbrella of military spouses are unemployed at 21%. But the reality is when you start looking at hotspots, those are the spots that we need to focus on because the unemployment rate has remained stagnant for at least 5 years. And we keep trying to address it with these umbrella solutions that work for everybody when in reality, we need to start looking, in my opinion, we need to start looking at some of these locations that are actually struggling more than others. And Okinawa is one of them, which is why I think the project is so important as a demonstration to show that unemployment is actually much higher potentially in Okinawa than it is for the even overall military spouse unemployment rate. And if you could drill down that number in Okinawa, then you might be able to make an impact in the overall military spouse unemployment rate. So the data I think we need to start looking at is by installation, what does unemployment look like so that these military spouses can have an idea of what they're getting themselves into so that they know, you know, can my family afford to move to this location or do I potentially need to stay behind? And I know that that's a tough conversation to have whenever we're talking about military family quality of life, because I think the DOD's priority has always been to keep military families together, and absolutely we should be doing that. But I don't think that we should withhold the information that allows individuals and the families to make that choice for themselves to say, look, we really can't make this sacrifice. It's not going to work for me. I'm a nurse professionally. I see that the unemployment rate is 49% in Okinawa. It's probably best that I stay here and jumpstart my career while you go there for a couple of years and then we reconnect. I've had a lot of spouses have that conversation. I wish I had known. And now I'm in this situation now. And I think we owe it to the spouses to just have the information so that they can make that decision.
And that's a conversation that we see in the Okinawa nurse group that is on Facebook, where people are asking, what's the job like out there? Should I stay home? This is my education. This is where I am. And I think Elaine and I also talked about, I know I got some of my information from the, I think it was the 2021 active duty spouse survey. And we have this whole, it looks like it's from the Defense Personnel Analytics Center. But what Elaine and I were talking about is that it would be nice if we had an unbiased report that's maybe not originating from some, like an organization like the DHA. I'm not sure what organization that would be, but to get this unbiased data where we really do have it at the installation level to be able to guide families more appropriately.
At that local level and that regional level, when you started gathering this data and talking to folks, what sort of assistance did you get from local officials out there? And what was the response once the report was finished?
I actually think it was overwhelmingly positive. And I know that there's a lot of military spouses who struggle with speaking up for their needs within the system, because it is it's almost intimidating looking at this chain of command with, you know, generals and their wives or husbands involved in some of the quality of life issues. But I have to say that Japan was actually overwhelmingly supportive. We had the spouse of Lieutenant General Rupp, who's the commander of U.S. Forces Japan. She opened the workshop with the U.S. ambassador to Japan spouse, Mrs. Amy Rule, and they were both, you know, very excited to hear what the spouses had to say, because they acknowledged that, you know, if look, there's spouses who are unemployed, we absolutely want to be utilizing these resources. And from there, they've made connections with higher level active duty individuals so that we could get the active duty support behind some of the things that could be done locally. So I know that they've done some career fairs. I know that there's been more direct higher authority positions that have been sent out since these workshops. They're doing things that they can at their level. And then they're communicating up to DC what some of the needs of the spouses are, which I think is fabulous. I cannot speak more highly enough of the leadership out in Japan for this project.
And the approach was really to give a voice to the active duty spouse and the civilians that were involved too. And so that's where, I mean, the focus groups were really just allowing the participants to speak. And then we basically just organized the thoughts of what they did, like what they told us, and took their stories and basically used those stories to then come up with the solutions. And they came up with the solutions actually in the second workshop. And that's basically what the report is. So it's not so much, I think we just facilitated their voices to be heard. And that's what the point of this is.
That's Kelly Pretorius, a PhD healthcare researcher and licensed nurse practitioner. Also talking with Elaine Sejung, an Air Force spouse, public health researcher, and another co-author of the report we've been discussing. They are both with the group Hire Okie Spouses. More discussion on military spouse unemployment and healthcare in just a minute. We'll be back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Servin. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking with Kelly Pretorius and Elaine Sejung with the group Hire Okie Spouses about military spouse unemployment and healthcare in Japan and around the world, and specifically with Japan, how it can be that there is a 49% unemployment rate among people with healthcare training who are military spouses in Japan, and simultaneously a healthcare access crisis there. I'm really curious if you heard anything that helped explain why, for example, these direct hire authorities that people know about aren't being used. Because it really does sound like folks at the local level who could be making different decisions to help out could be utilizing those. And the reason I think this specific question is important is this is a story that I've heard for years around the world with every civilian hiring authority in the Department of Defense. A lot of authorities out there, but they are rarely used. And I don't know if the impediment is cultural, if somebody's waiting for somebody to go use these authorities first to you know, create some kind of permission structure to do it. I don't know. What did you hear, if anything, that might help explain some of that?
I would say we just heard stories more of desperation and specific examples of how this was impacting individuals and their inability to work, their inability to get employment, their inability to maintain their licensure. I felt that there was overall a lack of understanding in the hiring process, a very convoluted system that's not clear. It's difficult to apply. There's a complete lack of understanding in what a military family is experiencing and why you need part-time jobs, why you need per diem jobs, why you can't have these requirements. So as a participant, someone that facilitated it, I guess, I didn't get the sense of any discussion from HR. Elaine, I don't know if you want to give any more information about that.
Yeah, so I know the individuals who facilitated the discussion with the active duty and the GS civilians, some of which were HR. And I believe, you know, Kelly, to your point, it was a lack of information and yes, a lack of education and understanding, which is why we recently saw from the White House a handbook that went out. And I can't recall the title specifically, but it is a handbook for hiring managers to better understand how to utilize military spouses for employment, because there are tools in the toolbox, but not everybody's thinking about, oh, how do I hire a military spouse, right? That's not top of mind. So it is an educational gap, I believe.
But again, are the jobs even there in the first place? And that's right, where I'm not sure. I don't know if they are until that crisis occurred. And then we had this whole influx of contractors. And so I think that that's a big problem too. It's that not only do we not have the positions per se, but then you also then need someone to initiate the direct hire. And so it's kind of a whole complicated situation that you have going on. And then it's further complicated by the needs of healthcare personnel and all the credentialing that we have to maintain and all the training that we have to have. And then so you're really putting spouses at a significant disadvantage during their tour of duty. And that also extends to the civilians as well.
So stepping back to what Elaine talked about a second ago, it sounds like a lot of this really is training. And that's a good area to pivot to one of the main recommendations that you had. Talk about your recommendation for increased training services at these MTFs, because I think that really is not specific to Japan. It's something that could benefit essentially any MTF outside the continental United States.
So Kelly, I'm going to let you tackle training that nurses need that's really difficult actually to find out in Okinawa. And that was something that was clearly brought up in the workshop by a lot of the spouses, not only the new ones who needed training, but the ones who needed to maintain their credentials. So I'm going to let Kelly try to answer that one.
Sure.
Well, I should ask Jared, were you asking more about training at the MTF level as far as their knowledge of the direct hire? Or are you talking about the training for the medical professionals?
I think both are interesting. You want to start us off on medical professionals, and then maybe Elaine can tackle some of the stuff around training for hiring and readiness at the MTFs.
I have to say, I was really shocked. So Jared, you and I have spoken quite a bit, and I think you knew that I couldn't get a job. And so I ended up working as adjunct faculty for the local university that teaches a lot of active duty. And I was really surprised that they didn't have like a school of nursing or some type of medical training. And so that goes to kind of really demonstrate the complete lack of training. So most hospitals will have nurse residency programs and all these extra programs to facilitate the growth of a nurse into practice and other medical professionals too. And so I would say that that doesn't exist in general at the MTF. And I think that there's a lot of room there because you basically have this surplus of healthcare providers at different levels within their training. And if you could facilitate whether they're needing clinical rotations, expanding their, so maybe you have someone that's only ever worked in pediatrics, but they're very interested in working in labor and delivery. Why not create a bridge to enable that to happen? And so I think it would be interesting if you could have somebody kind of to facilitate that, to really leverage all of these people that have some training, but maybe not at the strict requirements that some of the job postings are. I think that there's easy ways to go around that in a way that provides additional training to some of these people. You're also, because otherwise you basically then have all of these people that are not going to be able to maintain their licensure depending on where they are. And you're basically really creating significant barriers in the trajectory of their careers once they do return stateside. So I was actually telling Elaine, for me, for instance, I volunteered to maintain my licensure. I had to do that, right? So I worked for free. Now I'm back stateside and I'm going to be working at the hospital again, of course, and I'm not getting credit for any of the time. So my salary is lower than what it would have been had I actually had worked for those 2 years because my volunteering isn't working. So it really matters in the long run. We're also talking to people that end up losing their licensure because they're just not capable of it. And when you lose your licensure, then you have to come back, you have to resit for your boards. And it kind of depends on the state, but it's worth somebody taking the initiative to say, let's have some trainings here. Hi, I will initiate something where I can say, okay, you have some experience in pediatrics, but not labor and delivery. Let's have a bridge program here. So I just think there's a lot of potential there. And that has to do with the requirements that are in most of the job postings that we have found. A lot of the people do not meet those requirements, but it doesn't mean that they shouldn't. And I should say that that's not necessarily in line with requirements that we see in civilian hospitals necessarily either.
Some of this sounds like it gets back to our big data gap problem, because tell me if I'm overstating this, because but it sounds like no one really knows what the potential addressable talent pool out there is.
100%.
No one knows who's on board and has skills that could be extended into other critical areas or is interested in extending their skills into critical areas. No one knows who needs education to keep their training, to keep their certification current. There's very little known about this civilian, especially nursing workforce.
Yeah. And I should say, and then in this project, because this was really more of like a qualitative analysis, right? And in voicing with a lot of people's concerns. And so in the focus groups that we had, we heard a lot of these stories, right? But we don't have hard numbers. And that's where it is a good argument for, we really need these numbers. And there's some extremely talented people that we've engaged with that could do amazing things if we could tap into that resource.
Yeah, and that's actually, Kelly, to expand on that a little bit, we've had spouses who have tried to advocate for employment and be told, well, you're just an anecdotal story. Where's the data? And that's almost an unfair response because there is no data. So we're trying to help create the argument for better data.
And then let's talk about that. There is a recommendation that you have, Elaine, on better training at the MTF level just for medical readiness, which I think gets a little bit to this data question as well, but also helping local installation personnel understand some of what their needs are and what could be done to better get their arms around that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we haven't touched on that's a recommendation is to create a repository of healthcare spouses or spouses who can readily be deployed in the event of an emergency, but also be quickly hired in the event that they need additional resources. And we just don't have that capability. But there's programs within the federal government that already exist as examples of that. So, for instance, the Medical Reserve Corps, now that's a volunteer program. But it works with healthcare professionals at the local level to quickly activate them in an emergency and be able to supplement local healthcare resources with these volunteers. So that's one example. The other one is like the FEMA reserves. You know, we have reservists that we can readily activate for emergencies. It only makes sense to be able to do this at the MTFs. One of the things that I mention whenever I give presentations to the active duty leadership is my grandmother was a nurse during World War II. And when I went and, you know, saw the tour of Pearl Harbor, they talked about the military spouses who responded quickly to the casualties. And we actually have no system to do that. And these systems that were put in place to hire individuals and check their backgrounds and credential them and all these things have actually slowed down some of that quick response that we need. And so while they're beneficial, we need to figure out a way to be able to work around them when we quickly need to be able to activate those resources.
This is a weird thought, but I mean, DOD knows who generally most spouses are, at least by name, DOB, Social Security number. You could add a field in that DMDC entry that says profession too, so that when their spouse's orders are cut, they know with a 5 or 6 months
Great idea.
notice, oh, there's a nurse coming too, in addition to the service member.
And that was one of the recommendations that the report says too, is kind of before you're sending a family, let's start this process early. Let's pair up what vacancies do you see happening, who's going to be leaving soon, and how can we start this onboarding process early? Because we're not recommending, I'm not saying anyone can skip a background check. I'm not, but it's just saying, can we start that process early? We have spouses that know that they're going to be coming out here. They want to start this process early. And so that was also another recommendation, too.
We are talking with Kelly Pretorius and Elaine Sejung from Hire Oki Spouses about military spouse unemployment and healthcare in Japan. They're back with us for a few more minutes after one more break. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. This is on DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. A few more minutes left with Kelly Pretorius and Elaine Sejung. They are both volunteer researchers with Hire Oki Spouses, just out with a new report about how DoD can potentially reduce military spouse unemployment and increase access to healthcare at the same time. Another thing I definitely want to hit on in terms of your recommendations is the decentralization of hiring, because that's a huge barrier that you found too, right? Having to coordinate a lot of this activity back through people in CONUS through three different levels when that may not be entirely necessary. Can you talk about some of the problems that creates and what could be done about it?
I just want to mention that in my focus group that somebody was going through the interview process, for instance, and they had stayed up, I think it was till at least midnight, to do an interview through one of the stages of their interview process, and then ended up being like stood up by whomever it was that was going to interview them. And so I think that was a good example of the challenges that we're facing when you live in Japan and trying to connect. So not only do you have the time change, but it's a significant time change. And so that is a significant barrier. So if you actually had somebody local that you could speak with, which we don't have, I think that that could alleviate a lot of barriers. So for the most part, when you go through the job application process, there is not a point of contact for you to ask questions to. So you can't say, I don't really know, do I meet the requirements for this job? Is this what you're really looking for? There's not a way that you can have that conversation. So it was our recommendation that instead of having everybody stateside, if we could have at least have a Japan representative that was maybe, you know, actually located in Japan, maybe not even specifically Okinawa, but that that would really help to facilitate the hiring process as well, because that was a significant barrier that we identified amongst most of the participants too.
Yeah, and some of the individuals who are involved in the actual onboarding themselves ranged from being located in Hawaii to being located in San Antonio with AFPC. And so coordinating among all of these different entities took time, because you're not only dealing with the time difference between Okinawa and Hawaii, now you're having to deal with the time difference between Hawaii and San Antonio and Okinawa and San Antonio. And when you get all of those pieces into the mix, it just takes so much longer, and it already takes a long time stateside. So if overseas, they could have more autonomy to make some of those decisions rather than have to report back to both Hawaii and to, you know, San Antonio or DC or wherever that location is, at least you could cut down some of the time that's required for the actual onboarding once you've been hired.
There's also strict, the postings for the most part are quite strict. Like it might say day only, night only. And it seems that there's a lot of limitations in the flexibility to meet the needs of our families and where they are. And so you're dealing with families that are, they have spouses that are deploying for months on end. They might have young children. They have limited access to childcare. And so I think it's also just kind of a gentle overhaul of the postings, if you do even have a posting, with a more realistic expectation of the community that you're trying to serve and work with. And so a little bit more flexibility in the shifts that you're asking to be covered, et cetera, is really necessary for this population.
Yeah, and I'll tag on to that with the flexibility of the scheduling. It appears as though they're able to do that a little bit more with the Red Cross volunteers. And they're relying heavily on a lot of those Red Cross volunteers to fill positions that could potentially be paid positions. And that is creating some heartburn among the spouses who are volunteering a lot of their time and not necessarily getting paid for it. And so I know that there's been a little bit of concerns on, can the MTF create these part-time or per diem positions? But in a way, they're already doing it with the volunteers. So it seems feasible. They just have to potentially put a little bit more work into figuring out how to do it within the structure of the hiring process.
And Kelly, as we start to wind down here, this is something that I had not really been tracking, but you are, as a health researcher. As I understand it, it turns out that access to data is a bigger problem for people in your field who want to get access to basically any kind of DoD data for research purposes.
When we talk about data collecting and the limited data available, I have been surprised, because I was trying to obtain some data to do some analysis and do a little bit more digging. And there are some pretty decent barriers where I'm not able to access that data. So in this situation, we don't have this data about spousal employment, unemployment. It would be helpful to have it at the installation level. But I just want to also make a whole nother point that we don't even have access to the hospital level data, that we don't have access to the MTF data. I don't even know their health outcome data. I, as a researcher, am not able to access that data. I'm not able to run my own analyses on this. Their reporting structures are completely different. And so when we talk about military healthcare, I think it's also important to put it within that context to understand that a lot of this data, even if we had it, is not available for everyone to access it. And only certain people have access to it. And so that also limits a lot of what we can do, but I think it also limits our understanding of the quality of healthcare that's being delivered, the number of people that really aren't having access. So it's just a very complicated system. So I don't know if it's something where we're going to say, we really need this data and we'd love for it to be public, although I understand it's a little bit of a national security measure, that really, it does complicate things that there's such a, I don't know what the correct term is, it's like a safeguard where that knowledge is not public for the most part. Even if we're asking for this data, I would also ask for it to be public so that people can actually see it. And we can say, actually, the employment rate is quite high. And we had this many deliveries, but let's know their, I want to know the maternal health outcomes in, at Naval Hospital. I want to know all of this information, and I can't have access to that.
Yeah, and I would actually say another part of the data that I think would be good to know about is how much our military spouses volunteering their time, how many hours are going into that, and make that available to the public. Because I have had of probably one of the biggest concerns of spouses who weren't involved in the project is, you know, what's going on with our military spouse volunteers, and is there some form of labor exploitation occurring? And I had a spouse reach out to me, stateside actually, who's not even involved in healthcare. So this has nothing to do with Okinawa, has nothing to do with healthcare, but, she worked as a religious education coordinator, and she was working as a military spouse, but, contractor. So her own independent contract to provide service as a religious education coordinator at the chapel on base. And they changed the contract to a large contract umbrella to cover all of the religious employee, you know, entities underneath the chapel. And that then undercut her salary. And she had been a two-time award-winning worker to then be offered payment for something short of minimum wage. And she said, look, I can't do this. I can't work for less than minimum wage, but I'm happy to stay in this position until you can find somebody. And she then was not paid for 2 months of her time because the contractor didn't have the funds to pay her. So I think that we need to start talking about some fair opportunities for employment when it comes to the spouses who are so desperate. I mean, we've got a very clearly vulnerable population of individuals who have a very high unemployment rate, and they're willing to help the community as much as they can, but how can we do that ethically and make sure that they're fairly compensated? And I think that discussion needs to be had.
It's such an important point on the potential exploitation front. And I'm not even saying that anyone's exploiting people intentionally, right, but it's almost a de facto situation because most of these folks literally have no other options because they can't work in the Japanese economy or anywhere else, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And then if you have to maintain your licensure, you're told the only option is to volunteer with the Red Cross. And so then that's what a lot of us do because we don't know what else you can do. But I think Elaine's point on compensation is also a point that is worth making because it's also listed in the report specifically, because what the nurses, and I don't mean to differentiate and say nursing only, but for the most part, the compensation is pretty dismal compared to what you would make stateside. And so I think that that's important to account for because a lot of times it doesn't necessarily cover the cost of childcare, et cetera, depending on the circumstance of the family. And so fair market rate compensation really needs to be taken into account too. I know I was even, I think I was offered a job to work at WIC. And when I looked at what I was like, this doesn't, I can't pay for it. It's not worth it. It wasn't worth me to do that job because it wouldn't cover my childcare costs. And so it is almost exploiting that population because there's no other options for spouses.
And Kelly, I don't know if you have the numbers right in front of you or in front of your head, but can you give folks a sense of what you mean when you say the compensation is dismal? I mean, are we talking 5% below CONUS wages,
Elaine,
50%?
Do we know?
We don't, but I can say that the reason why it's so dismal is the local hires do not get offered the housing allowance that if you were hired from a stateside location, you would get somewhere around $3,000 more a month. But if you're hired locally, which the military spouses are, and it's almost the only way that you could get hired, it's very, very difficult. So you use your military spouse preference and you get hired locally, but then you accept that you are not going to be getting any sort of housing allowance or any additional allowances that would come along with that. And that just gives you the very baseline salary that's offered. So for instance, I took a 40% pay cut to work in Okinawa versus what I was getting paid working at the University of Nebraska Medical Center.
Jared, I can tell you, because I was telling Elaine, I had also in my desperation, had applied to be like a school nurse within DoDEA, which I didn't even get an interview for. But in my desperation, also signed up to be a sub for the school nurse. And for that, I think it was like maybe $100 a day, maybe. And again, I've had almost 20 years of pediatric healthcare experience. I have my MPH and my PhD. and then when I worked as adjunct faculty and I was teaching, I think when I calculated out how much I was working for the hour, my husband and I were like, this is not smart. And so I ended up resigning. It just didn't make sense because it was so minimal. I think I was paid like $2,000 for a whole semester. And I spent hours because I was so invested in my students, and it was primarily active duty, that I would spend hours in prepping my classes, teaching, staying after to teach one-on-one. So I think it permeates beyond the healthcare system. It's also DoDEA. People are severely underpaid within that system too, because you kind of can. We have no other options in that setting.
Because they're local hires, because I do think that the DoDEA teachers are paid pretty well if they come from stateside locations.
That is Elaine Sejong, an Air Force spouse and public health researcher. We've also been talking with Kelly Pretorius, a PhD healthcare researcher and licensed nurse practitioner. They are both with the group Hire Oki Spouses. You can find a link to their full report on our website at federalnewsnetwork.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's edition of On DoD. Thanks as always for tuning in. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD on Federal News Network. Tune in Wednesday mornings at 11 or subscribe to this show on iTunes or Podcast One.